Thank you, everybody. Welcome. So glad to see you here tonight. I'd like to thank Paula Finnegan and the Theosophical Society for having me, and the 10 Directions Zen community for kind of making it happen, connecting me with the Theosophical Society. So thank you very much for that. So I'd like to begin tonight with a short reading from this book that Paula mentioned, Who is Singing in Chinese? Notes from a 100 Year Zen Retreat. And this is the account, really, of some 30 years of Zen practice in my life, and the last 18 of which have been in the Quantum School of Zen, which is a branch, we might say, of the Korean San or Korean Zen tradition. I should ask, how many people here do meditation of some kind on a daily basis? Doesn't have to be Zen. Ah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Nearly everybody. maybe this passage will resonate with you. It's just a short one. This is called, from chapter 2, A Place Inside. Inside each of us is a place. This place is better than the beach, better than the mountains, better than the cruise ship, the health spa, or dance club. It is better than anything. This place is before waking and dreaming, before name and form, before birth and death. This place is before thinking. In this place, all our prayers are answered, and all our dreams come true. In this place, the dead are brought back to life. Actually, it's not a place at all, and not inside or outside either. But you don't have to take my word for it. You can go there anytime and see for yourself. It is not far away. To seek this place is the proper work of a human being and can utterly transform your life and the lives of those around you. It can also be the adventure of a lifetime. Let me tell you about it. So as a description of meditation, that might be a little bit cryptic, so I can probably explain a little bit by telling a story from a number of years ago at work. At the time, some years ago, I worked for a very large insurance company, and my boss, a very nice man, was interested in my Zen practice. At that time, I didn't share with too many people that I considered myself a Buddhist or that I practiced Zen, but as I say, he was a great guy, and so I confided in him. And he wanted to know, what's that experience of meditation like? What's Zen meditation like? So I started to explain it a little bit to him, got into it a couple of minutes, and then he interrupted me and said, oh, I get it. I understand now. It's just like opening day of gun deer season when I'm up in my tree stand. And I said, well, John, explain to me what you mean. Tell me a little bit about the tree stand, you know, what happens up there. So he explained. He said, well, you know, in the wee hours, not quite light yet, he climbs up into the tree stand. I think he had dragged a chair up there, but there's nothing else up there. And it's a very small space. And in that space, he can only sit or stand for long minutes or hours. And there's nothing to do. You can wait for your deer to appear, but there's really nothing going on up there, and nothing to distract you. But there is this significant feeling of physical constraint or confinement. And I said, yeah, that resonates with any Zen student or probably any practitioner of meditation. If you sit like this, you're confined to this roughly 24 by 30 inch mat, and you're told not to move, and there's nothing to do, no place to go, nothing to distract you. Your body doesn't move, But as a consequence, your mind moves, maybe a lot, maybe a lot. So I said, John, so far so good. What else happens in the tree stand? So John told me that in the tree stand, once he's up there and settled, he gets busy placing his attention downrange to where the deer is going to appear. All right. So his tree stand faces some kind of a tree line and an opening from that tree line, some kind of meadow or opening where he expects the deer to emerge from the woods. And so he stands up there with his deer rifle and waits for that deer, and his attention becomes very concentrated, very narrow, very focused, kind of has blinders on, and all he's aware of is that spot downrange where that deer is going to appear. And I told him, yeah, that's certainly familiar to any meditator, not just Zen, but certainly any Buddhist meditator. That's one of the strands or threads of meditation practice that we could call one-pointed mind, or perhaps just concentration. So that's the ability to put your mind, to put your attention anywhere you want it, and then to hold it there. And of course, that's what he was doing, looking down at the downrange at where the deer was going to appear. In Sanskrit, that's called shamatha, which means calm abiding. And again, that's the ability to just let your focus, your attention, rest there in one spot. Then he told me about this other kind of attention that occurred in the deer stand. As time went on, this became more apparent to him. So this was a growing awareness of a more global, more all-encompassing attention. So he was aware of a lot of things, if not at once, at least a lot of things around him with his attention shifting kind of globally. So he explained that as he looked downrange, kind of keeping his attention on this clearing, at the same time he became aware of snow from the trees blowing against his cheek. He became aware of his feet and toes really freezing, you know, getting colder and more numb. He told me about hearing the sound of a branch rubbing another branch or creaking in the woods, you know, somewhere in the woods. And he told me about, you know, becoming aware of a thought appearing somewhere in his mind. So all these things going on. And in the Buddhist tradition generally, we could say that this is vipassana, which means clear seeing. And in our school of Zen, that first awareness we call one mind, that concentration we call one mind. This awareness we call clear mind. So everything appears clearly just as it is. You know, the snow on the cheek, the sound of the branch, and so forth, the thought appearing, everything appears just as it is, and we say that's truth. But that awareness is clear mind. And then he told me about another kind of experience with this tree stand meditation that surely every meditator is familiar with, whether you do Zen meditation or some other kind of meditation, and that is an experience where he lost either thread. So if one mind and clear mind are two threads of Buddhist meditation, he lost the thread, all the threads entirely, and he would kind of come to, you know, he'd realize 20 minutes had passed, and it wasn't that he fell asleep, but his mind had gone somewhere. So he was thinking about last week at work, or next week during the holidays, or some other thing, but, you know, kind of lost the thread of any kind of attention, and his mind just kind of unspooled. And probably everybody has experienced that. You don't have to be a meditator to to have felt that. You could be riding on a bus or standing in the shower, and that kind of thing happens all the time. And we call that lost mind. So, you know, one mind, clear mind, and lost mind. Of course, there's a big difference between, despite the similarities, between being in a tree stand for deer hunting season and doing Zen meditation. The Buddha taught that all human beings, make a big mistake. And that mistake is that we don't know who or what we are. As a consequence of that mistake, not knowing who or what we are, we think we're a self, especially a separate self, and we think that we're separate from everything and everybody else. So we're constantly looking outside ourselves. We're looking out here. Our attention is always focused out here, kind of like with the deer. We're always wanting something. We're always attaching to things. The Buddha taught that this attachment is the source of our suffering and of the suffering of everyone around us. This wanting, this attaching to outside things. Once, many years ago, I was told the story that our founding teacher, Zen Master Sung San, was asked by someone at a talk like this during the question and answer period, why are there nuclear bombs? You know, that's a good question for the Zen Master. Why are there nuclear bombs? And all he said was, somebody wants something. Somebody wants something. So that's very good Buddhist teaching. That's right in line with what Shakyamuni Buddha taught. So Zen goes against the grain of all that. Zen completely goes upstream from that. And instead of our looking out here, so our attention focused like a beam out here, it tells us to turn that attention around and shine that light inward. So we shine our attention inward and look directly in at the nature of the mind. That's all. It's actually very, very simple. So that's why in Paula's very nice introduction, she spoke about this clear, simple, and direct Zen teaching, which simply directs us to turn our attention around, direct it inward to the nature of the mind. And if we do that, nothing is hidden. Eventually, we see everything. If we do it long enough, then it's really quite miraculous. If we do this very simple practice for a long time, but very earnestly, then it utterly transforms body, heart, and mind. Very, kind of very hard to believe. You can teach this thing in 5 minutes, but if you keep doing it all your life, it's completely transformational. So that's Zen. Very simple, very clear, very direct. So what makes Korean Zen different? What's distinctive about this Korean San tradition or Korean Zen, of which the Kwannon school of Zen is a part? And that is the central technique or core practice that is sometimes referred to in Korean as Shi Shim Ma. Shi Shim Ma. And that means simply, what is this? What is this? And that's not an intellectual inquiry. That's a mind practice technique of holding that question very, very deeply while we're looking inside. What is this? And what it really means, another way of talking about it, is what is this mind? What is this mind? So what is this mind points to something. It points to what is this just now that's seeing through these eyes? Just now, what's seeing through these eyes? Just now, what is it that's hearing through these ears? Just now, what is it that's smelling through these nostrils? Just now, what is it that feels through this skin? Just now, what is it that's aware of these thoughts appearing, these thoughts arising? What is that? So that's what Shi Shim Ma means. What is this? What is this mind? So again, just very simple, clear, and direct, always pointing at this mind. So why do that? Why sit and meditate with that question? You know, what is this? You do that in order to get don't know mind, what we call don't know mind, or the mind of not knowing. Or sometimes we say before thinking mind. So that's the mind before any thinking arises, before any thinking appears. Before thinking mind, don't know mind, the mind of not knowing. And actually perceiving this not knowing very, very clearly is itself enlightenment. Is itself enlightenment. So it's actually, you don't need to. We'll do some meditation in a little bit, in a few minutes. We'll do some Korean Zen-style meditation. But it doesn't take, you don't even have to do that in order to get a taste of this don't know or this before thinking mind. We can each get a taste of that very easily. So if I ask the group a couple of questions, and if you look at your response inside to those questions, you may get some feeling for this don't know mind. The only thing I ask is that when I ask these questions, that you don't rely on stuff you learned as a kid, your religious upbringing, any religious or metaphysical beliefs you might have. You don't rely on what your teachers told you. You don't rely on anybody else's idea. This has to be your response, your idea. So the two questions are pretty simple, really. Where do you go after you die? Where do you go after you die? Now, many of us think we know the answer to that because of our religious training or upbringing. But if you put that aside, then what? Then what? Probably fewer people believe they know the answer to the second question, which is, where do you come from? Where did you come from before you were born? Before you were born, where did you come from? I mean, you're here now, and then you die, and you know, maybe you go someplace else, but where were you before you were born? So if you just even take a moment or two and look into that with some sincerity, you get a feeling of being stuck, right? You don't know. You don't know. You kind of come up against this wall right away, this stuck place. And in our Korean Zen tradition, in this Zen practice that I've been training in for some years, this is actually a good place to be. It's can often be uncomfortable, and those of us who practice this Zen don't like being there, but it's actually a very good place to be, in this place of not knowing. Because in that place of not knowing, all kinds of things can appear. All kinds of insight can appear from that place. So, it actually one of the hazards of this this Zen training all these years is that if you hang around Zen masters long enough, they're always trying to give you an experience of don't know whether you want one or not. Maybe when you least expect it, right? So I have a little story in the book about that. I'd like to read that to you. So this chapter is called Live Words. That's a Zen expression, and it begins with a what's called a koan, or in Korea they say kongan, which some of you may know is a strange kind of enigmatic riddle-like thing, a story of an encounter between two Zen practitioners, often a teacher and a student. And so it opens with just a little encounter like this that's important to the story I'm going to tell about my own encounter with a guy named Zen Master Dae Kwong. So anyway, first the historical thing. One day, Mongong Sunim was drinking tea with Zen Master Suwol. In the middle of their conversation, Suwol picked up a teacup and said, "Don't say this is a teacup. Don't say this is not a teacup. What can you say?" Mongong answered correctly, so Suwol was very happy. And then this Kongan or Koan asked the student, "If you were there, what could you answer? Don't say this is a teacup. Don't say this is not a teacup. What can you say?" All right. So there we were, just Zen Master Dae Kwong and I, having breakfast in a diner on Madison's east side. This morning found him not in the long gray robe and brown casa of last night's public talk, but wearing his street clothes, which was to say the gray cotton monk's pants and large buttoned tunic that looked distressingly like pajamas. Despite his Asian monastic dress and Dharma name, Dae Kwong Sansa was not Chinese, Korean, or Japanese, but hailed from Lincoln, Nebraska, and spoke with the flat drawl of the Great Plains. At that time, I would have put him in his early 50s. A looming presence at 6 foot something, Dae Kwong Sunim was square-jawed and powerfully built with the gleaming skull of the ordained monk. He met the world with a clear, penetrating, and thoroughly unsettling gaze. When strolling down State Street near campus, I had watched him stand impassively in gray monk's clothes, white athletic shoes, and a gray Irish bucket hat, while the crowd parted around him like a torrent flowing around a mountain. His center, as we say, did not move. One of my new Dharma sisters suspected that Dae Kwong Sunim could read her mind, and the senior Zen students who hovered around him looked thoroughly cowed, if not downright frightened, a reaction he did little to discourage. Pajamas or no, you would not mess with this guy. And then we skip a little bit, which was maybe why I found myself sitting in a restaurant with Dae Kwong Sunim this morning. It was his new favorite breakfast spot in town, an old neighborhood gas station converted into a 1950s style diner with lots of chrome, gleaming swivel counter stools, and vintage Fiestaware pitchers displayed behind the counter. Neon art and old black and white photographs covered the walls. Amid the clatter of tables being bussed and the din of a Saturday morning breakfast crowd, the conversation at our booth faltered and faded into silence. We drank our coffee and looked at each other. We looked away and drank more coffee. "This is hard work," I was thinking, as I racked my brain for something to say. Dae Kwong Sunim, it appeared, was a man of very few words, and by natural temperament, I was reserved to the point of being functionally mute. Still, it's always a Zen master's job to teach, and so he lobbed a question like a bomb into the strained silence between us. "How does that coffee taste?" he asked. Oh, shit. An odd question under the circumstances, don't you think? Now he had my attention. Zen Master Dae Kwong and this school of Korean Zen may have been new to me, but I had been around the Zen world long enough to know that this was not a social question, not our waitress asking, "How is everything tasting, hon?" Something more was going on. You see, Dikuang Sanim is heir to the ancient live words tradition of Tang Dynasty China. At that time, Zen teachers and their students lived and worked closely together, exchanging challenges and teaching on the fly, and attainment of the enlightened mind was demonstrated, or not, amid the nitty-gritty of daily life, of pounding rice, cleaning the latrine, or drinking tea. Or in our case, drinking coffee. Too bad for me, but Dikuang Sanim's question was a living, breathing example of live words in action. Talking about this is tricky to say the least, because live words point directly to our before-thinking mind, where words and speech cannot go. Zen masters use live words to express or elicit an experience of true nature. Dead words, on the other hand, are dead precisely because they are one step removed from life. They reflect our habitual entanglement in the dream of the small self and our estrangement from the fundamental realities of our lives. How does that coffee taste? This was a live words challenge, an invitation, if you will, to Dharma combat. Dikuang Sanim was not looking to me for an explanation. His question was an invitation to cut off thinking and respond in a way that was clear, alive, and appropriate to the situation at hand. He was asking for a response that sprang directly from the before-thinking mind. Inevitably, flurries of thoughts presented themselves. Well, I could talk about the darkness of the roast, the coffee's balance or acidity, but this was diner coffee, not Starbucks, and anyway, some live words were called for. Thinking, as we often say, could not help me. Dikuang Sanim was waiting for an answer, and to hesitate for even a moment signaled already dead. How does that coffee taste? I felt defensive, put on the spot. Of course, I was completely stuck. I mumbled a social reply. I had barely opened my mouth to speak before Dikuang Sanim was absently gazing off somewhere, to all appearances, utterly bored and no longer listening. In Zen, it is said that the question is more important than any answer that you could provide. During the next couple years, whenever Zen Master Dikuang was in town and we had coffee or a meal together, he posed the same question. Right about the time I realized I might have an answer for him, he stopped asking. So actually, you don't even need to hang around with a Zen master to get an experience of this don't know, because life presents these all the time. And the title of this book, Who is Singing in Chinese, is actually an example of just such a situation. This is something my father said on his deathbed. It was his final gift to me, and gave me a very strong experience of don't know. So I'd like to just, I've kind of been reading a lot, so I'd like to just tell you about it, even though I write about it in the book. So maybe 8 years ago, something like that, 8 or 9 years ago, my Zen teacher had assigned me a 100-day practice period, a 100-day retreat of sorts. But I'm a married guy. I have a wife. At the time, I'm retired now, but at the time I had a corporate job, and I couldn't do as many people in our school do and go off to a cabin somewhere and sit Zen for 100 days. So my teacher devised a fiendish schedule designed to allow me to practice some 4 hours a day for 100 days amid the nitty-gritty of a marriage relationship, a corporate job, commuting back and forth to work, various family obligations, all this kind of thing. And then the clinker in this was at day 50, at the midpoint of the retreat, you add an hour of practice at midnight for 5 hours of Zen practice per day. So. And that runs for just a week, so it doesn't go for the remaining 50 days. But at any rate, so there you are, doing your 4 hours of Zen practice a day and working and so forth. And then at midnight, for a week, you get up and do another hour, and then you go back to bed. But then the alarm rings pretty soon at 3:30, and you have to get up and practice Zen some more and get ready for work. So in the midst of this 100-day retreat, my father was dying in a nursing home in Florida, down in Florida. And we had visited him recently, but at this point he was just kind of declining. And part of the retreat was to do chanting practice in our school of Zen. We do lots of different kinds of practices, but certainly chanting is one of them. And we have a special a part of the chanting service that's called special chanting. And a lot of times the practice is to offer some intention to those who are suffering. It could be everybody, or it could be somebody you have in mind. So every evening when it was time for special chanting, you know, after dinner, I'd go in my office and close the door. And I should have brought one, but we use this so-called wooden fish drum. There's a picture of it on the cover of the book. It's called a moktok. Moktok. In Japan, they call it a mokugyo, but in Korea, it's a moktok. And it makes kind of a hollow, tok, tok, tok sound, kind of. And you beat that to keep time with the chanting. And so, I'd go into my office, do the special chanting. And, at first when the retreat started, I was pretty sure my wife would think I was crazy, when she heard this racket, coming. But after a while, I didn't care, and part of the reason I didn't care was because she seemed to tolerate the previous days of chanting, but also because, Dad was dying, and, day after day, my intention got more and more pure, I guess you might say, or refined, and I just really wanted to dedicate the energy of this chanting to Dad. And he had no idea I was doing any of this. I mean, I tried not to tell my folks too much about this, So there I am, just banging away and chanting at the top of my lungs, just like crazy, day after day after day. Well, on day 33, I forgot the critical point. The chanting is done in what we call what could be called Sino-Korean. So it's really Chinese, but it's done Chinese as pronounced by Korean people, transliterated that way. So there I am, pounding away, chanting in Sino-Korean. Day 33, we're called down to Florida. The nurses let us know, if you want to see your father again, once more in this lifetime, you better get down here fast. So my brothers and I and our wives, we all get airfare, head down to Florida, to the Fort Myers area, get off the plane, go driving to the nursing home. And when my wife and I walked in the room, Dad was completely clear, knew us, recognized us, knew us, was cheerful, smiled, kissed us, and so forth. But it was very clear that from one moment to the next, he was kind of moving in and out of the room, from one moment to the next, now here, now not. And so we sit down and we're talking with my mom, and Dad calls out from the bed, will there be singing after? And I'm thinking, that's odd. Does he mean after he's gone? And then he calls out once more, who is singing in Chinese? That gave me a very, very strong feeling of this don't know, this don't know. Because, we can come up with a lot of explanations, but the explanations really don't satisfy, do they? I don't want to read too much, but just a word or two about that. So, (clears throat) So Dad, you know, in the text here, calls out, "Who is singing in Chinese?" Now, don't you have to ask yourself, what was that about? Doesn't it stop your mind in its tracks, if only for an instant? Does it open a gap in the seemingly impervious wall of your thinking, letting in a fresh breeze from who knows where? Of course, we are all so quick to try to close the gap, to paper over the hole in the plaster, to shore up the crumbling foundation of the house. And so we create explanations, which in the end don't explain anything. We hang on for dear life to somebody else's thinking in the face of this enormous don't know. Friends later suggested any number of theories to explain what had happened, that this special chanting practice from my 100-day retreat had somehow accompanied me into Dad's room, that his mind and mine had simply connected, that for all I knew, he had made a wrong turn, missing Methodist heaven and stumbling into the pure land of Amida Buddha, where I suppose they chant in Chinese. Can any of these explanations really satisfy? In the words of the eminent ancestor Dawi, whatever side you come at it from, that's not it, you're wrong. As I later told a Dharma friend to whom I recounted this story, if we think we understand this life, then we're not keeping a sufficiently broad view. All right, so that's probably enough reading. I think maybe we could try a little Korean-style Zen meditation. So, it's very simple. Everybody just kind of sit up straight. And if you can, if it's natural for your body, if you can sit up straight without leaning back, that could be helpful. But if you're leaning back, that's okay too. Feet should be planted on the floor unless you've adopted a cross-legged posture. And your spine should be upright, but everything relaxed, shoulders relaxed. We tuck the chin just a little. And what that does is it raises the crown of the head as if it were suspended on a string, so that all the vertebrae are kind of stacked nicely, one on top of the other. So chin tucked a little bit. Eyes remain open. We're not trying to go anyplace different. We're trying to just unlike. My boss, John, with his lost mind in the tree stand, we're trying to stay in our body, in this room, hearing the blower, seeing the lights. So, eyes open, but at a 45-degree angle, soft gaze. You can soften your gaze. So you can still see, but you're not really looking at anything real sharply. In our tradition, we put the right hand down, palm up, and then the left hand rests in the right, and then the thumbs touch very lightly so that you're kind of forming an oval like that. We just breathe naturally. Don't need to do anything special with the breath. Breathe through the nose if you can. Also, we relax the abdomen completely. We just let the belly fall forward and down if we can. Just relax that. And if you can, kind of let your attention drop to just below your navel. That point we call the tanjin. That's considered the spiritual center. And then I'd like all of us to try this shi shim ma. This what is this? And I'll explain how to do that. So on the inhalation or in-breath, silently to oneself, you repeat, what is this? Or if that's too remote, you could say to yourself, what am I? What is this or what am I? And then on the exhalation or out-breath, you can either just pay attention to that out-breath or if you like, and this may make it a little easier, it provides a little more of an anchor, you could say to yourself, don't know. So, what am I? Don't know. Like that. And our meditation sessions start usually with three slaps of a stick called a chukpi, but I don't have one with me, so I'll just clap my hands, and they end the same way. So we'll try maybe 5 minutes and see how that goes. So let's take some questions, or if you have any comments about what we just did, that's fine too.
Regardless if you're new to meditation or mindfulness, or you've been a long-time practitioner, the mind always wanders. What is a good way to keep bringing your mind back to the question or to your breath? If you could elaborate a little bit about that.
Sure. My answer is going to sound a little bit like an answer I heard probably 30 years ago from an American Zen teacher named Philip Kaplow Roshi. He said, you grasp the will by grasping the will. It's kind of a bootstrap answer, but actually that's... That's a good question. Everybody, as you said, and as I said earlier, has had that experience of the mind moving, the mind wandering. And the main thing is just to be aware, as soon as we're aware that we've lost the thread, that the mind has moved, that we've been somewhere, actually right then, we're already awake. I mean, that's already kind of a little wake up or enlightenment moment. So you've already done it. You've already done the work. So then just don't be lazy. You know, then just bring the mind, the attention back to the mind practice technique, whatever it is that you're doing. You know, what is this or what am I, don't know, or perhaps the breath, following the breath, or counting the breath, just gently but firmly bring it back. Over time, the ability to not have it move is from doing just that. It's like you're. It's very unglamorous. It's like you're building a muscle. It's like going to the gym. You're just building this habit, and this. Kind of mental muscle to keep bringing your attention, your focus back to just now, to this moment, and to wherever you have told yourself you want your attention to be, you know, to just keep bringing that focus back. Having said that, now does that answer your question so far?
Yeah, it helps.
Having said that, I've been telling members of our Sangha for some time that actually this business of meditation it's a win-win. You can't lose. You really can't lose because we talked about these two threads. concentration, and then this insight element. So actually, people don't often appreciate, but when their mind wanders, and they see all the things that appear when their mind wanders, they're seeing their mind habits. They're seeing their particular pattern. So you're getting very wise to yourself. You're getting very intimate with yourself, getting to know who and what kind of animal you are, you know. And that's insight. I mean, people often beat themselves up and say, oh, I couldn't hold the mind practice technique, you know, my concentration was horrible, all I could do was daydream or maybe fall asleep or something. But you know what, even when you're doing those things, you're learning who and what you are. And eventually, you have the opportunity to start to see through those things.
We do have a question from online. How does one harmonize the meditation based in a seed thought versus meditation based in observing and just let awareness be?
Possibly. Okay, so all right. So maybe harmonizing the concentration element and the insight element. Yeah. So those things... There's really no need to harmonize anything. Those two threads of our meditation effort are always present. They're always present, and sometimes concentration is stronger. Sometimes that side is stronger, and so we're able to. It's possible to do a very aggressive kind of meditation where it's just, you know, cutting thought, really, just cut, you know, just really aggressively, forcibly, you know, coming back, you know, just this moment, just cut. Anytime a thought appears, just cut it off. And that may have its uses, but that's kind of an example of a very, very strong, like 90% or 100%, you know, this concentration, this one-pointed style. But inevitably, these things fluctuate. So we might have very strong concentration at some point, and then at other times, maybe we're not keeping as strong a concentration. But you know, the Buddha taught the middle way, and so then it's possible for something to appear. And in my view, this is just, you know, my view from personal experience, I believe that it's actually, if we maintain kind of a balance, or as good a balance as we can, so that we have our awareness on whatever the object of our meditation is, but we're otherwise relaxed, then, you know, things can appear. And where will this wisdom come from? Where will our creativity come from? Where will our insight come from, if not from those things? How will we come into a new relationship to our thinking, to our thoughts, if no thought ever appears, if we just cut, you know? So. Maybe that wasn't precisely the question, but just naturally, by natural process, based on whether we're tired or whether we're very alert, the balance between those two elements is going to change all the time. But then our job is to just do the practice, just do the practices as best we can, and when our mind habits appear, then we get to see them possibly for the 10,000th or millionth time. But at some point, seeing them, we'll begin to see through them. So, you know, going back to my original statement around this, that meditation is a win-win. even when we're seeing our junk, you know, time and time and time again, this is, in my view, this is positive. This is a very positive development, because each time we see our stuff, we take a little bit of energy away from that. Okay? Each time we see our stuff and then come back, we take some energy from those mind habits, from that material. Yes?
I've been trying or allowing my formal meditation practice to inhabit my daily activities and trying to be mindful all the time as much as possible. And my question is, how do we balance the desire to not be judgmental, to being open to experience and to not thinking too much and just experience, with the practical need to make decisions, sometimes rapid decisions, interacting and getting things done? How do we balance that?
Okay, thank you. That's a great question. In our tradition, we teach that when you're doing something, you should just do it 100%. So, and you know, that's our practice style, which is not to say that other styles are wrong. But when you talk about mindfulness, to me, what mindfulness really means is just paying attention, right? And paying attention to what you're doing. And I once asked Zen Master Dai Quang, you know, how do I integrate my formal practice with my daily life? And he said, when you're doing something, just do it 100%. And then he said something even more shocking. He was elaborating a little bit, and he said something that you wouldn't expect to hear from a Zen monk. He said, when fighting, just fight 100%. So, you know, we have ideas about being being compassionate or holding particular feelings or mind states about people or things or situations, but actually in the Zen teaching, it's all about letting go of those. It's at a recent weekend retreat, we had a teaching story about this really happened. A Westerner who became a monk in Korea, a Zen monk in Korea, and he approached his superior with a suggestion about, you know, how to be more helpful or more compassionate with some big event that they were putting on. He wanted to help, you know, rather than doing the thing that he was doing. And the sergeant monk said, "Throw that mind away!" You know, "Throw that mind away!" And so, Zen, in our Zen teaching, it comes back to just, you know, throw any mind that you make away. So don't make compassion, don't make mindfulness, don't make kindness, don't make attention, don't make any of that stuff. Just pay attention and then do the thing 100%. And that just means with as much attention and as much of your energy and focus as you can bring to bear on whatever it is you're doing. So that could be washing the dishes or chopping carrots or, you know, or being at work. Could be anything, but then just do that. And that's another way of training off the cushion to do really the same kind of thing that we're doing on the cushion. So what we're doing on the cushion is always coming back. We're putting down whatever thinking appears, just, you know, putting that down and coming back to being in this room, being aware of our breathing, being aware of the blower, of the lights, the blue carpet. You know, there's nothing else. Nothing else. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Thank you. Good question.
I'm intrigued by the time aspect in the practice. Is it home in a discipline, or is it wearing a mind down, the fact that you practice for so long?
Okay, so I think I understand what you're getting at. Thank you. That's a good question. As I was talking about previously, the practice is really kind of, in a certain way, unglamorous. You know, we're allowing old, deeply entrenched habits to erode slowly, 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 wearing them away, and we're building new habits. And so time is important to that effort. Time spent in practice is important to that effort. Not that it has to all be formal practice. It can be informal practice off the mat and cushion. But time is important to that because we have, it's a effortful, time-consuming process, as everybody knows, to build any new habit of any kind. And it's especially effortful to change any existing old bad habit, especially the kind of deeply entrenched mind habits that each of us as human beings brings into this life. It's a long it's a long process. It doesn't have to be, but for many of us, I'm sort of a late bloomer in this thing. I mean, I've been sitting for probably 30 years on a daily basis, but much longer than that on, kind of before that sort of stop and start. And it took me a long time. Well, even my teacher told me at a certain point, well, gee, it sure took you long enough. And he's right. But, it takes as long as it takes, right? And I'm, I'm a late bloomer. I don't mind.
Oftentimes, authors, they'll write a book and they'll realize that they learn something new about the topic they're writing on. And additionally, they will also learn something about themselves.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could comment on that, please.
Oh, thank you. That's a nice question. The thing that comes most immediately to mind is that I never... Without Zen practice, I never would have believed it possible that I could write, let alone publish a book. Okay, I've always, in my various careers, I've always written a lot, but pretty dry stuff. And so I attribute the ability, the creativity that. Went into the book, and the confidence or the trust to write it came directly out of this practice. I promise you that came directly out of this practice. I never could have done it otherwise. One of the teachings in our school is trust yourself 100%. That doesn't mean trust your small ego-driven I, my, me mind. That means trust your true self. And I did that because when I first started to write, I was afflicted by what I like to think of as the cruel editor. The cruel editor lived up here, and nothing was good enough, nothing was acceptable. But thanks to this beautiful Zen practice, I was able to get through that, get beyond that, and find some kind of voice, and then just go with that. And I attribute it completely to this practice. As far as what I've learned from writing it, practice doesn't hold still. There's a need to continue to practice always, I'm working on another book, but you know, this one I'm thoroughly sick of. You know, it feels like old hat, and it feels like, well, okay, I sort of get what I was trying to present there, but I'm not so interested in that now, and let's move on to the next thing. And that's the movement of our Zen practice too, is to always keep practicing that the need to do that never ends. I don't know if that helps, but yeah.